It's All Things Considered on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. If you look at the front page of the New York Times from July 21, 1969, the first thing that jumps out at you is the banner headline, Men Walk on Moon. But something that might escape all but the eagle-eyed among us is the byline, the name of the man who wrote that historic story. His name is John Noble Wilford, and the 1955 University of Tennessee graduate was the man the paper of record tapped to document man's greatest adventure. Wilford spent decades covering science for the Times, and he joined me in the studio this week to talk about what it was like to cover science before, during, and after the heady days of Apollo. At first, he says he wasn't that impressed with the space age.
I was never a great fan of science fiction. I had never really thought much about going to the moon or anywhere else in space. I was quite impressed, of course, that we have broken the bonds of gravity and someday we will be flying in space. But I thought of it more in the context of the Cold War. Because at that time, I thought I was going to be a political foreign policy journalist. And later, I moved into science and space.
Well, that takes us to the front page story on the New York Times, July 21st, 1969, the banner headline, Man Walks on the Moon. Yours was the byline that accompanied that article. The article has since been praised for its blending of scientific and technical detail with a reader-friendly writing style. So talk to me a little bit about how you approach writing about very detailed scientific or technological concepts in a way that's easy for the reader to understand.
Mm-hmm. The night before the landing was to occur, I began for the first time to think, what am I going to say? How am I going to approach this, which will probably be the biggest story I ever write in my career? And I thought, well, you know, a lot of people, a lot of journalists are going to overwrite it, that they're going to have a lot of exclamatory phrasing and a lot of heavy organ music. And I thought the simplest thing to do is to say the simplest that you can, that men have landed and walked on the moon. And so that was my lead. I'm a journalist. I'm not a science writer in the pure sense. I was writing it for people who are not scientists and trying to phrase it in a historic setting, but then have some touches. When Armstrong was trying to find a safe landing place, I happened to notice in the transcript what his heart rate was at that time compared to what it was normally. And at that time, I mentioned his heart rate, how it escalated. And a number of people have pointed that out as saying more about what Armstrong was thinking and feeling than anything any words could say. So you try to, something like, particularly like a landing on the moon, you try to humanize it.
A little earlier in that answer, you mentioned that you deliberately tried to avoid the sort of the trumpeting and the heralding of new era that opened today of humanity.
Yeah.
Did your editors give you any pushback on that to say, no, this needs to be more flowery, this needs to be...
No, well, I wrote out, in my hotel room, I wrote out the simple sentence so that I wouldn't forget it the next morning. And as soon as the editors, some of the editors came into work in New York, editors are always coming in late when you're getting up real early. But when one of the editors who was coordinating this came in, I called him up and I told Henry that, let me just read you what I think our lead should be. And I read him this, and I said, what do you think? He said, it sounds all right, but I'll pass it around. And I never heard back. And so I assumed that meant it was okay, and it ran just the way I wrote it.
When you were reporting on the space program in the 1960s, science seemed to represent the promise of a better future, that there wasn't any problem we couldn't solve with the help of science. How has the perception of science's role in society changed in the last half century?
Well, when I started in science journalism, which was in the 60s, there was a bit of a gee whiz quality to science writing, medical writing, technology writing, and that coincided with the general attitude, particularly in the beginning of that decade, of the inevitability of progress. Well, through the 60s, there was so much that was not progressive that was happening to our country. In Vietnam, the race riots, the assassinations, it didn't seem like a very great time to be alive and to be banking on progress. So particularly after a few more moon landings, people got tired of it. And there was more concern about the war in Vietnam, about the racial relations and that sort of thing, as well as there was a lot more doubt about the inevitability of progress. And the environmental movement was beginning to take shape, somewhat because of the space program, because we were seeing images of Earth as a very small ball out in space, beautiful but small and vulnerable. And we were reading about our polluted rivers and polluted air and a lot of things. Technology was not considered automatically good because we could see some of the risks that were involved. We could see that not all technology was necessarily for the better. And that changed. Science writers began to react less as agents of wonder and progress, and more as weighing risks and benefits. And that's become much more of a factor ever since then.
Your more recent work for the New York Times includes stories that cover genetics and evolution. And in those fields and many others, of course, there have been some remarkable breakthroughs in the last 40 to 50 years, from mapping the human genome to discoveries in particle physics that rewrite some of the textbooks. But none of those stories have gotten the above-the-fold, front-page, banner headline treatment that Apollo 11 and some of the other stories that you covered did. Yeah. Why do you think that subsequent science breakthroughs have not gotten that kind of attention in the press?
Going to the moon was not just a science story. It was a story of human adventure. It was a story with profound implications for the Cold War. It was couched as a race. This was a human adventure involving a race between two adversaries in what was called the Cold War. And as such, it was profoundly interesting. And some of the more recent science stories that do involve the discovery of the Higgs boson, for example, that's tough going. I mean, I think our writer, Dennis Overby, does an excellent job of elucidating the importance and the sense of what we're learning from particle physics, but it takes some good writing, and not every journalist is necessarily a good writer.
What are the problems that you see with the way science is reported in modern American media and maybe even global media? And the reason I ask that is we have tools now that you couldn't have dreamed of in 1969 when you had teletype and typewriters and carbon paper. And today we have the ability to Skype with a physicist at CERN if we'd like to. In an instant, we can be taken around the world to get these answers, to go to where the science stories are happening. But there's also a lot of misinformation out there on the internet and a lot of misinterpretations. The science reporter as a beat is kind of a dying art in this country. We don't see as many dedicated science reporters. So what are some of the problems that you've observed and as a science reporter in the way you look at how science is reported?
Because you can communicate more fluidly and imaginatively doesn't mean that you're going to communicate what is really important. There's always a tendency to write on the surface of news about science and medicine, the hoopla type of coverage. I think that what concerns me is that there is getting to be another kind of hype in a coverage, which is to make the story sometimes more interesting than it really is, to hype up the lead of the story, to get the reader in with sort of anecdotal leads that sometimes bury the news or the importance of the news. So that this doesn't always happen, but there is a tendency, because of the competition from the internet, the digital competition, because they can write things that happen almost simultaneously with the happening. Science writers on places like the New York Times and a few others do cover a lot of these things more responsibly, but there are a lot of papers and a lot of outlets that couldn't be bothered unless it says something about what you eat and how it's going to cause cancer or some of these things that are on the border of being irresponsible.
I was born after the Apollo program. I was born 13 years after Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt last left a set of human footprints on the moon. For me and my peers in our generation and everybody after, landing on the moon and going to the moon is our history. It's not our present, it's not our future, at least as far as any foreseeable future is concerned. But you were there. Are you disappointed with the trajectory of the manned spaceflight program after Apollo came to an end? It seems to be quite driftless.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm to some extent disappointed, obviously, because I spent 5 or 6 years of my life and career getting us to the moon and enjoying it, and I think I did it responsibly. And I, all through that period, I sort of assumed that maybe in the next 20 years, as NASA was predicting, that we would have men landing on Mars and a lot of other good things. But that didn't happen. In some ways, the fact that we don't have the robust manned program that we had in the 60s doesn't bother me because I've come to think of the unmanned space exploration of the planets, the Voyagers, the Vikings, the Mariners, which gave us our first close-up looks of all the planets. I find that more exciting in a way, more interesting, because that's real exploration. No people on board, but we were learning. We were seeing things that we never saw before. Something that in a telescope even was not much more than a pinpoint of light was suddenly from 10,000 or 15,000 miles out was a solid body or a gaseous body. And that to me filled my imagination more than landing on the moon. But I'm glad I covered the landing on the moon too. But it's just that there's a lot, I mean, most of what happens in space today we take for granted. It's part of the infrastructure, in effect, of living on Earth. The communication satellites, the weather satellites, a lot of things that we do today in space, nobody thinks about it. Being in space, it's something else.
Does it surprise you how quickly we've become acclimated to the idea? Because again, in my research on the space program, I've always been a NASA junkie since I was a kid. There was that gee whiz factor that you talked about, that, wow, for the first time, we can. There's a ball up there, and we can send telephone calls to it, and or we can get television transmissions from across the Atlantic Ocean, thanks to Early Bird and Telstar and things like that. That it was really profoundly amazing that this could be done, and as you said today, we complain when our smartphones aren't fast enough, despite the fact the signal's going 22,000 miles into space and coming back is a minor miracle. Do you find that that's a little frustrating, that people don't take it more seriously, or that they're not, have become so acclimated, so used to it, that it's become almost an afterthought?
Yeah. Well, I've heard it said that our laptops have more computer capability than the whole mission control had for Apollo 11. And so in that sense, it is a gee whiz type situation. Speaking of Early Bird and Telstar, and I remember being on a camping trip out in Oregon. The viewing of the heavens was spectacular there. And we had looked beforehand to when the Telstar, whatever it was, would be visible in Oregon. And so we stayed up late to watch Telstar. It went across and then it disappeared. But nobody now would go out and look. I think there are some places where you can see the International Space Station.
That's right.
But how many people go out to look for it?
Right.
No.
In 2012, you wrote the New York Times obituary for Neil Armstrong, the first man, of course, to walk on the moon, and getting back to that idea of how you've witnessed so much change over the course of your career and over your life, what went through your mind as you sat down to write the remembrance, the death notice for a man who at one point in his life represented the embodiment of the future, but now was the past?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never faced. To some extent, it was difficult to decide how to do it, partly because Armstrong himself was not all that articulate. He was economical in his words and thoughts. But he had done an oral history for NASA back quite some years ago, and He was interviewed by a couple of historians, and they got him over a period of 2 days to really say some thoughtful things, and that helped me get there. I mean, it's easy to say how to get into that story. Obituaries usually are very easy to get the first two or three paragraphs, but sometimes the nut graph, as we call it, which sort of is the transition into the body of the person's life, that can be hard to condense. But I mean, you obviously play around with the notion that here the man who said that's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind type of thing, as the first human to walk on another world, died yesterday, and that was the easy part. But it occurred to me that I wanted to say more about how he had handled his post-flight career, his life. And I had communicated with him quite a bit over the years because I admired how he handled himself. He didn't go around and try to make money on it. He went to the University of Cincinnati to teach engineering, but how he looked upon himself and how he tried to live an ordinary life, which of course is impossible for someone in his stature. And I tried to end on some of that because I genuinely admired the way he handled himself.
What excites you about covering science today?
I'm getting old. I'm 80 years old, but I still have a desk and everything at the Times. And after the Moon program, I began branching out into other things. I still covered the early shuttles, but I started branching out into other subjects that interested me and that no one else was doing. That included paleontology, archaeology, and after a certain time, I started doing more astronomy and astrophysics. And I said, well, you know, I redefined my beat as the long ago and far away. I covered the long ago on Earth and the far away in space. And I did it as story. It was more like a storytelling function. And that's very satisfying.
John Noble Wilford, a retired science editor and science writer for the New York Times. Before that, he was with Time Magazine. John Noble Wilford, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you.